Across the UK on Freeview Channel 730 and on smart devices. This is RNIB Connect Radio.
I'm Ravi Sagu, and a very warm welcome to Blind Notes on RNIB Connect Radio. In this conversation series, I'll be speaking to different musicians each week, exploring their portfolio of work, their own musical loves, inspirations, and what drives them to perform the music they make. I myself have experience of impaired vision as I suffer from keratoconus, and I'm keen to explore how our guests have overcome their visual disabilities to make their own music and achieve their musical goals. Our guest today is a multi-instrumentalist from London who has really made a name as one of the world's most successful producers with 160 gold and platinum discs. He studied law, opened his own power plant studio, and started producing records including the 10 million selling album Diamond Life for Sade. As well as working with the likes of Sting, Big Country, Herbie Hancock, The Style Council, and Elvis Costello, he's also the co-founder of Blue Raincoat Music, managing and publishing artists, and recently has taken up the role as chair of disability charity Scope. With me today on Blind Notes is Robin Miller, CBE. Here's an example of his production talents. It's Working Week with Inner City Blues. Robin Miller, welcome to the show. That was Inner City Blues by Working Week. Tell me why this was such an important song for you.
There were two ways that turned me from being a musician into a record producer. One was the extraordinary impact that an album made in 1969 by Marvin Gaye, which actually spoke about social division, deprivation and poverty, Ravi, reached number one in the American hit parade. Mm-hmm. And that was an extraordinary milestone and a bridge across which a lot of young people walked. The idea that you could be so bold about these issues. But the second thing was the production values. The whole album, Let's Get It On, was a mood piece, really, a properly arranged, choreographed mood piece, highlighting space, strings and percussion. Uh-huh. And anyone who knows my work as a producer would say strings, space and percussion loom very large. When I was working and training as an apprentice in the recording studio in France, I went on a day release for a year course to the university in Paris. And what I chose to do was to learn contemporary pop arranging because I loved the idea of being able to actually know how to score strings and arrange, you know, complex music around. And I think that was the differentiator starting out, you know, as a young producer. A lot of them were just audio engineers or maybe just former musicians. And my sort of heroes going back, George Martin, Arif Mardin, they knew how to arrange records. So Inner City Blues was a track that I recorded almost as my first exercise trying to apply what I'd learnt and what inspired me, you know, into an actual recording. And I'm pretty happy with the results still, even now, actually.
Robin, I'm going to take it way back to the beginning. When did you start playing music and what instruments did you veer towards?
Started singing at school, had a few piano lessons, not many. Incredibly lucky being a kid born in the early 50s because by the time, I was too young for Elvis Presley, obviously, but The Shadows, Cliff Richard and The Beatles came along. Hearing the electric guitar, the twang of the electric guitar dominating records for the first time, not the music my parents had played in the 50s, was electrifying. And my dad bought me a 5 quid guitar. And like everybody else, I think, I started playing along to Shadows records. And then he bought me a little book called Play in a Day by Burt Wheaton, which I have read so many interviews, Ravi, over the last 40 years of, you know, from Eric Clapton to Midge Ure to Peter Frampton and people who all had this little orange-coloured soft book, Play in a Day, with the smiling Burt Wheaton on the cover, you know, as after teaching you how to use the plectrum, you know, the pick that you went backwards and forwards. Very simple diagrams of tablature of how what fingers to press down to hold the chords. Dad buys you a little guitar and you go from there.
I wish I had that book. Over the pandemic, I actually picked up a guitar. I can play records on the radio, no problem. But, oh, I'm a horrendous guitar player in real life. Really did need that book. Play in a day.
You needed play in a day.
Exactly. Clearly, I went down the wrong route for that one. Robin, now, growing up, I believe your eyesight wasn't great.
No. I couldn't see in the dark. I mean, it's amazing when you think about it. I read only the other day a little thing about retinitis pigmentosa, and it said people very rarely go completely blind. Well, I went completely blind 35 years ago, so I obviously got a double dose. You know, thinking back, and little things like, I've never seen a star.
Yeah.
So I can't imagine the night sky, because the first thing that goes with retinitis is your ability to see in the dark. And I remember the fear of going to school under my own steam, and as the nights drew in, and then there's that moment, you know, in October where they put the clocks back an hour. And that meant going home in the dark. And I could see, but not in the dark. So I used to have to guide my way home by memorizing where the streetlights were, you know, and the gaps between the streetlights. But every now and then you'd get distracted and I'd walk smack into a tree. So it wasn't so much that it would get worse and worse, because it did. But obviously you kind of get, it creeps up on you. But bumping into things, bumping into objects, not seeing a cricket ball and realising that other people can see that ball coming, because you get tunnel vision. So if the ball came straight at me, I could catch it. If it looped up from above, or if it was a shot, you know, from the left or from the right, I wouldn't see it. And I remember being at school and people being given tracing paper to put over a map of the British Isles. And they said, look, just take a pencil and trace the British Isles that you'll see through the tracing paper. And all I could see was the tracing paper. So, you know, I had very strange vision, because in one sense, I could see someone's face. I could draw quite well. You know, I could see quite a lot of detail, but it was clearly sort of very different.
You clearly didn't let it hold you back, because you pretty much went down a musical route early on. When did you decide that music's my thing and I'm going to try and make a living out of this now?
Well, it's a funny thing, Ravi. I did music at school. I actually started a couple of folk clubs and blues clubs, and I did play in some local gigs. But my mum and dad were quite traditional immigrant parents. It's all about education. It's all about climbing up the ladder. And they were very worried about my eyesight. So they said that I should study something sensible. By the way, telling me to study law was not sensible. It involves a huge amount of reading all the time. So it was actually, you know, I mean, bless them, you know, it was not sensible. But anyway, they said, if you finish your law studies, then we will support you in whatever you want to do next. Well, so I did finish my law studies and I went straight into music from there. Back after a year, I sort of went backwards and got a job as an apprentice, you know, in a recording studio. So I dare say they would have supported me, but in the end, I didn't need it, because the great thing about apprenticeships, of course, is you're being paid to learn. And I was working at a residential recording studio just outside Paris. I couldn't get work in the UK. And I think I couldn't get work in the UK, I think because of my bad eyesight, Ravi. I think, you know, well, still the case, isn't it? They didn't want to take the chance. They thought it was a bit strange and could be a lot of effort. And I found a person in Paris. I still hold on to this, and it still affects what I do now regarding diversity, and particularly access to employment and apprenticeships. Because after all these people say, no, we can't do this, no, we can't do this, someone told me, try my luck in Paris. And I met this guy, Pierre, and he ran the studio that I then worked in for 3 years. And I said, look, I think I ought to tell you, I don't see very well in the dark, and I know I'm be running around and might kick microphones over, and I don't know whether I'll be able to see all the knobs. And he just went, oh, that's all right, we'll work around it, it's fine. Just like that. That's inclusion 40 years before its time.
That's fantastic to hear, especially all those years ago.
Extraordinary. I mean, and I really do bless that guy, because the way he just said, like, you know, just like that, it's fine, we'll work around it, it's fine.
Yep.
And I sort of feel now that what I'm doing 50 years later is trying to say to, you know, major multi-billion pound companies wondering and worrying about employing people with disabilities, if they can just have that, it's fine, it'll be okay, we'll work around it, it's okay.
Absolutely. I'm going to take you back to 1974. You recorded the album Cat's Eyes. Given your visual impairment, did that title have a special relevance?
Yeah. I don't even remember. No, the title track, it wasn't called Cat's Eyes, okay? But sitting in the evening, waiting for the morning sky to come by, sitting in the lateness, hoping that something would catch my eye. We ain't all got eyeballs like a cat. We can't all adjust in 10 seconds flat. Sitting in the evening, waiting for the morning sky. That was the time in my life where in daylight and in good lighting, I felt okay. By the way, it was all about attracting girls, really. obviously. Sunrise, no lies. Blue skies can hypnotize. Sun down, eyes frown. No skies, only sounds for me.
So those were the lyrics?
Yeah, that's how I felt. And amazing having that record of how deeply I felt about it then is quite amazing to me, because I'm a different person. You know, I've been on that journey, come out the other end. But it's amazing. And it's a good reminder for me, because I kind of go, that's what it's like being young, going through that experience. So I sort of hold on to it really as a way of motivating me to try to do things.
Now, this song I'm about to play from that album is Catch Can, featuring some impressive musicians.
Oh, yeah.
So tell me more.
My sister started going out with Mick Taylor. And Mick Taylor was the guitarist at the time with a blues band called John Mayall's Blues Breakers. He'd taken over from Eric Clapton, but he was about 2 years older than me. And I, of course, sort of idolised him in a way because, you know, apart from anything else, he had all these proper professional electric guitars and vintage amplifiers. And I used to go to his little flat in Paddington. And he came back, I was sitting with my sister, and he came back and he said, I've had a strange sort of day. He said, I think I've just had an audition for the Rolling Stones. He got the job. He was only in the band for 4 years. But during those 4 years, of course, my life changed forever because I had access to behind the scenes of what it was like after you'd made it, you know, in the music business. Like, fast forward, Robin, we're going to drop you into the middle of the Rolling Stones. And because you're Mick Taylor's wife's brother, you know, you've got access to all areas, including, I went to the south of France when they were recording one of their records. I went on quite a lot of the European tour with them. And Mick introduced me to the people that ran Atlantic Records, who were the Stones record label, and they heard some of my songs and they gave me a record deal. Of course, entirely because of the amazing rarefied atmosphere that I stumbled into, we recorded it at the Beatles studio in Savile Row in London. Mick Taylor played guitar on a couple of tracks. The great Nicky Hopkins, who played on lots of Stones and other fantastic records. The great Bobby Keys, who died recently, sadly, who played saxophone on the great Stones records on Sticky Fingers and the other records, you know, at that time. Yeah, absolutely amazing. And Atlantic put the record out, and they put the first single out, Catch As Catch Can. And then, then I learned an awful lot, Ravi, because then Mick Taylor left the band abruptly, leaving them rather in the lurch on the brink of a European tour. And quite rightly, Mick Jagger and Keith Richard, well, no, Mick Jagger principally, I think, said, right, well, you can forget this Robin Miller record.
Oh, dear. Let's take a spin back to that very record from 1975. This is Robin Miller, Catch As Catch Can. Catch As Catch Can by my guest today, Robin Miller. You're listening to Blind Notes with Ravi Sagu on RNIB Connect Radio. There's lots more content online at the RNIB Connect website. Simply head along to rnibconnect.org.uk. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter as well. The handle is at RNIB Radio. So Robin, by this stage, you're a working musician now, you're touring, and I believe your visual impairment caused a bit of an accident on stage. Tell me about that.
I don't know whether a lot of listeners share this, Ravi, but well, in fact, I'm sure they do, you know. We've got our pride, we've got our dignity, we've got our rather spiky little carapace that you grow. You know, you can't help it, you can get grumpy at times, but you also feel like you're a burden. You don't want to be a burden. And it's only years later when you go back and talk to those people and say, I felt that the touring life was so difficult for all the rest of you having to take me around and, you know, leave. And they kind of go, what are you talking about? It was fine. You know, it was no problem at all. But you do feel like you're in the way. And then I was playing on stage at the Palais de Balthard in Paris, and I fell off the front of the stage. I didn't see the front of the stage. And I fell off. It was pretty high. And the worst of it was I broke the neck of my beloved cherry red Gibson Les Paul standard guitar.
No way.
And, of course, I didn't have any insurance. So I think my watershed moment was not quite as poignant as you might think, Ravi. I think it was basically, I've got to make a decision here. Do I keep touring and falling off stages? Because if I do, I've got to replace this guitar that took me 2.5 years to save up to buy, or not, you know. Because I wasn't going to go back and get a cheap, you know, Japanese guitar. No way, Jose. So that's when I decided to get a job in a studio. Stay put, if you like, you know, learn my music in one place.
And of course, you spoke about your experiences in Paris, how they were just so accommodating. It's nice to see that you've had that support throughout your career.
Yeah.
So how did you make the move from actual artist to producing records?
So I got a job in Paris as a junior in the studio, and I slept there. They had an accommodation. It was just outside Paris, actually. And by complete luck, the studio became very, very fashionable. It became fashionable for artists from America and the UK to go and work there. So you start making tea, plugging in microphones, watching people working, learning what they do,
yep,
putting the tape on and off, perhaps learning some tape editing, learning how the equipment works. And Elton John, David Bowie, Grateful Dead, who I then went on to work with 20 years later, half of Saturday Night Fever, Fleetwood Mac, all recorded there while I was watching. So I was watching really good producers working with really good bands on records that I would then later hear, you know, all over the radio and all over everywhere becoming. So I learned how good people made good records. And this is a model that led me directly to the Sade record you're talking about. Studios are not booked all the time, but they're full of expensive equipment. But obviously, the days before, someone could buy an Apple Mac and make music at home. So the studio manager had the idea that they could bring in young bands who seemed to have potential and put them in the studio like at night time or when the studio wasn't being used, sometimes at the weekend, because the French were quite into their 9 to 5. The American bands, not so much, but they needed someone to actually sit at the desk and record them. And of course, I was there because I lived there. I was the only one who lived there. So they sort of treated me as like a dog, really. And they said, right, you can record all the young bands. And on the back of a tape box, it's got a space to write down the names of all the songs, the title, the timing of all the songs. And then at the bottom left-hand corner, it says producer. And so rather cheekily, of all these young bands, a producer, I'd write my name rather than leave the box blank. So about 9 months later, I had got some notoriety because I'd played guitar on a track by a guy called Plastic Bertrand called Sa Plan Pour Moi, which became an international hit and is supposed to be the first punk record. But I played because they were in the studio. They wanted a certain sort of guitar. The guitarist hadn't turned up. They said, oh, Robin plays guitar. He'll do it. So I did. So that made the young punky bands want to work with me. And of course, suddenly punk became cool. And so I had a couple of records did okay, you know, started selling. And so much to the amusement of Pierre, who ran the studio, the record company started to ring up saying, do you know where we can get hold of this producer, Robin Miller? And he'd say, yeah, he's making sandwiches in the kitchen at the moment for the band that we've got booked in. There you go, lucky break, or whatever, you know, opportunism.
Well, let's hear Plastic Bertrand, Sa Plan Pour Moi, featuring Robin Miller on guitar. Sa Plan
times can be especially challenging for people with sight loss.
For dedicated advice, support, or to access our free talking books and reading services, call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
The helpline's open 8 till 8 on weekdays and Saturdays from 9 till 1.
Standing with you through every challenge. RNIB. See differently.
You're listening to Blind Notes with Ravi Sagu, and my guest today is record producer Robin Miller. So Robin, what is it you aim to achieve with Shadi's first album?
So I'd come back, I'd established the recording studio in Northwest London, a run-down old studio, and I was raising money for Chilean Solidarity to raise awareness of the horrible Pinochet regime, missing people. And because it was Latin America, I wanted to do a Latin jazz track, and I arranged it all properly, scored it out, and then I put the word out, please, will musicians who don't want to be paid come and play? So about 30 people turned up, and two of them were members of Sade's band, who I didn't know. So the following day, the manager rang up and said, two members of a band I manage worked with you at the studio last night. They really enjoyed it, and they really liked the fact that you could arrange music. I said, what's their music like? And he said, well, it's sort of jazzy, funky. So I met them, and they said, we love American sort of classic soul. She actually also loved Sinatra, but they loved Ray Charles, Gil Scott-Heron, lots of classic Philly soul, all of which, of course, was what I'd learnt to do. So I said, well, look, I'll give you the studio time to do two tracks if you'll let me arrange and produce them. It was like an opportunity, really. Of course, I couldn't afford to pay for, you know, a proper session orchestra or something. So we did the strings with synthesizers. The sax player and his brother put the parts together. I dragged in a friend of mine to play percussion. I played quite a lot of the percussion. I played some of the guitars. And so we kind of got something together which sounded like a sort of Quincy Jones, sort of Marvin Gaye classic, let's get it on sort of style, but with great simple songs and her great voice and really good young players on it. And the result is Diamond Life. And that's all it is. It's simply that, you know. We were all very confident it was very good. But, you know, when we finished the two tracks, the manager started taking them round to the record company and they couldn't get a record deal. And it took 8 or 9 months, I think.
No way.
And in the end, it was actually Sade's boyfriend had the very clever idea of putting her on a, she was a beautiful woman, but put her on the cover of a very trendy magazine, The Face, and then organised a hasty gig in a club in London. And there were 600 people queuing up to get outside. And her boyfriend also very cleverly contacted all his mates who worked for newspapers. So the Daily Mirror, The Sun, Daily Mail, they all photographed all these people waiting outside a club. So all the record companies who weren't interested were suddenly ringing up going, oh yes, about that band. We think they're great. We think they're great. We want to sign them up. That taught me a lot about, it doesn't matter how good the music is, but you need to play the game. You need to make it your game, actually, Ravi, I'd say. You need to make it, you need to embrace it and say it's a game and I enjoy playing it.
Shadi's Diamond Life album was incredibly successful, selling over 10 million records. But recording their second album was a very different experience, not from a music point of view, but personally. Tell me, what happened during the recording of Promise?
Do you know, to this day, I don't understand what happened. We were recording, the band wanted to get away from all the pressure that had come with the success of the first record. And they wanted to go away. And they said, shall we go to a residential studio in France? And of course, I was perfectly happy with that idea because that's where I'd learnt, not the same place. So we went there And the studio was in one building, and then there was a rather rickety, rocky path up the side of a hill to the accommodation area. And I literally do not know what happened, but after about 4 or 5 days, I realised that it was something to do with the sunlight or the, you know, the strength of the sun or something, that I was blind. You know, I couldn't find my way from the studio area back to my accommodation. I was missing steps. I was tripping over things. Then they would want to hang out down at the swimming pool, and there were scorpions in the toilet and I couldn't see them, and there were hornets flying around and I couldn't see them, and the desk was a rather old mixing console, and all the lines where you can see what, you know, where the volume is, where the tone is, have been mostly worn away, and so I couldn't see those. And I completely panicked. I said to myself, I can't cope. And I rang my wife and said, I can't cope, this is a nightmare, this is a complete and utter nightmare. She said, well, I'll come and get you. What are you going to say to the band? So I picked a fight with the band, a real fight with the band. That's all I can say. I said earlier on, Ravi, that you know, if you've got a disability, you do get this slightly kind of strange, grumpy, spiky skin, which you're not aware is there a lot of the time until something happens and it suddenly comes and you find yourself shouting and snarling and flailing around and furious. And so whatever happened, to this day, I don't remember what the argument was about, by the way. But of course, the argument was really about me being totally uptight and upset and all at sea with what had happened. I mean, look, I can't see anything now, but I'm sitting here in my studio now talking to you. I can do anything I want. I'd run about, change everything, move everything. I'm not blind in this place. And of course, I'd had my own studio in London. So I'd been going 200 metres from my house to my studio and back to my house, because I was working all the time because of Sade being so popular. You know, it's just work at work, work. Easy. Suddenly, I was a fish out of water. I didn't have anyone with me who would guide me around. Just grab an arm, just as you're walking along, just grab an arm. And yeah, I panicked, much to the band's complete bewilderment, I think. And I came back to London and I said, look, I sort of mumbled, look, I think there's a bit of a time pressure here. So what I'll do is, we finished half of the records. I'll bring them back to my studio in London where I'll do the mixing, the finishing, the post-production, get the records all finished and ready whilst you sort of carry on recording. Yeah, awful.
Let's take a spin back to that second album, Promise, and Shadi with The Sweetest Taboo. Robin, when you recorded your own album, Kiss and Tell, in 2002, it was nearly all of your own songs. But The Sweetest Taboo was on there. Why did you want to do your own version of that particular song?
Because I think it was written about me. There was an extraordinary moment about a year before I did that record where I was in my house and I got a thing through the door. And it was a note from Sade and it said, Robin, I don't normally pay much attention to these sort of things, but I think you and I should share this moment. And it was an American magazine called Vibe, which is the preeminent American black music Bible. And the Vibe magazine listeners had asked to vote for the greatest R&B records of all time. And number one was Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye. And number two was The Sweetest Taboo by Sade. And then below us were Ray Charles, Stevie Wonder. Just looking at this, I could imagine, you know, what it had meant to her. It's probably the record, I think, that I'm most proud of it when I hear it, if you see what I mean. You know, if I'm somewhere and I hear it come on the speakers in a restaurant or something, I still listen to it and I still go, that's pretty original, because it was taking a Latin American rhythm but actually playing it on a drum. Very difficult to play on a drum kit. All the parts, I remember every single moment I arranged that track And Sade still mentions that as what she thinks is my best production work with her. You've got to be a bit in love with an artist to work with them, but in a platonic way. But you've got to, in fact, it's only by it being platonic, you've got to allow yourself to fall in love with them, I think, because it's terribly important to them. You know, you're their producer, you're the custodian of not just what they're doing now, but possibly their future. So by the time you're into a second record, I think you're pretty devoted, you know, to that artist. And sometimes it's reciprocated and you feel it and you sense it. And I think that was the moment in my working relationship with her when I felt that it was reciprocated and we were pretty mutually devoted.
So, Robin, with your visual disability, in what ways has technology, as it's evolved over the years, helped you in your job as a record producer?
Well, I'm sitting talking to you, Ravi, here in my studio.
Yep.
And the way it's helped me is that once I stopped being able to see the knobs and buttons and switches, the economics of Robin Miller producing a record involved someone sitting there doing all the things that you needed to see to do. I'm now sitting here with you in my studio and I can record, I can arrange, I can produce, I can mix, I can master everything, all based around computer software. I type, it speaks, I move a mouse, you know, it speaks. It's incalculable. And of all the training that I did, I was resisting. But a lot of people do. You know, I resisted using a white stick for years. I resisted all sorts of acknowledgements for years. But I took a deep breath and thought, I've got to get this computer business is really important. So I signed on to the College for the Blind in Kilburn. And I signed up for the longest course they did on computing because I knew I had to get to understand a lot. And then I went on another course after that, then another course after that, because I decided I had to become really, really good at understanding not only how you use computers, but how you program computers. And best thing I ever did, Ravi, really, best thing I ever did.
Now, Robin, reflecting over your career, how do you think your relationship with music, how that's changed over the years, given your sight loss?
I think my sight loss actually opened the door to my success as a music producer and interpreter. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'd still be trying to, you know, play in clubs and things. Maybe I'd still be in a band. Maybe the band would have been successful. I don't know. But I think deciding it wasn't safe for me to travel around, having to stay in one place and realizing that all the things that had been difficult for me, I've never had an artist in any way, I think, I'm not sure I should work with Robin, he can't see. So I suppose I just chose the right path. And so I think it's not just my relationship with music, Ravi, it's my relationship to life and myself is that, you know, when you're lucky, is that there's one thing that you do that's better than anything else that you do. And you've got to put that in context, haven't you? So Robin, you can't see, in brackets, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is the one thing you can do that you do better than anything else you do and maybe better than a lot of other people do? And I found it by a process that was dictated by my eyesight completely and offering myself up rather than fighting, but embracing the fact that I couldn't see and needed to find people, find places, find workarounds. And my relationship with music is really simple. I don't define the music that I create or listen to by the two little rectangular boxes in front of me because I can't see them. So music to me is an environment. It simply exists in the space that I work in. And I'm absolutely certain that when people hear my mixes of other people's records or my own records, that they listen to it, think, I'm not sure quite how he's done that. I'm not sure quite, there's something about that that is kind of reaching out towards me. And I'm absolutely, and so I've been teaching people since 1983, and I'm still in touch with some of them, and some of them have gone on to win fantastic awards and do very well. And one thing they'll all say to me is that, you know, Robin, I still do what you taught me to do. And I say, what's that then, Jim? What's that then, Pete? When I'm getting a sound, I shut my eyes. I lean forward to the controls and I shut my eyes. I said, why do you do that? Well, because you don't see the red lights flashing saying you shouldn't be turning the knob that way. And you trust your ears and think that if it sounds good, it is good.
Robin Miller, CBE, thank you for joining us on Blind Notes today. A really fascinating insight into your life and music and your journey throughout. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Ravi. I think the way that you've conducted the interviews has been really thoughtful and helped.
I've really enjoyed it. And we're going to play out with a track from your 2002 LP, Kiss and Tell. This is Robin Miller, Sing It, Brother.
Love it.
Anything to say about this song on a personal note?
I wasn't much in touch with Sade at that time since the Vibe magazine thing. And I got a little note through the door in my house in Fulham. And it just said, Sing It, Brother, what a track, Sade XXX. No higher honour could there be.
Thank you, Robin. You've been listening to Blind Notes with me, Ravi Sagu, which is a Demos production supported by the Audio Content Fund for RNIB Connect Radio.